Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 154 with the title, From Burnout to Brilliance. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Emma Parnell. Emma is an L&D manager dedicated to fostering safe, inclusive environments where people can thrive and unlocking their potential to embrace their differences. And when I asked Emma to describe her superpower, she said it is her resilience, and she is inspired by people who have faced their toughest times head on and won. Hello, Emma. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanne. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be joining you today, and I'm excited to talk about all the things that I'm passionate about around learning and development and how we make sure that everybody's included and no one's left out. Even the smallest of voices need to be heard.
You're so right. And you reminded me when we first came on in the green room that we met tail end of last year at an L&D forum in London, if I remember right.
We did. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the Connect events held at London Wall. Yeah. And we got chatting. We got introduced by a mutual colleague, mutual friend. And we got chatting. One of the really interesting things I found out about that day, and certainly talking to you, is, you know, the drive for inclusion for everybody. And I've certainly seen over my 30-something year career, I can't remember exactly how many somethings that is, but certainly 30 years, seen a lot of changes in learning and development and a lot of changes in the working environment. And, you know, it's changed an awful lot in terms of being able to make efforts to include more people with, you know, differences, be that neurodiversity or other challenges that might be going on, disabilities, etc. And it's interesting that I feel there's still some way to go, but people are generally trying to embrace and trying to understand what diversity and inclusion really means and how they can just, you know, make sure that they employ the best of people. You know, particularly a question that you asked me was, what's my superpower? And I love that word superpower, because I think everybody's got their own, and it's the responsibility of HR perhaps, as well as learning and development and people who manage people, to find out what the superpower is of the person that they're hiring, because they can surprise you. And I think that diverse teams, which is not a new concept, but it's something that's still so massively important, diverse teams where you have people with different approaches to things. And, you know, you'll have, in most teams, you have your sort of louder people, I guess, people who are very confident, want to talk first. And then you'll have those who might be particularly quiet. But it's actually the quieter ones that you really, as a manager, need to dig down and get to know, because quietness doesn't mean that somebody hasn't got something to contribute. You know, quietness can be introverse, but it can also just be contemplative. Some people think before they speak and need to hear what everybody else is saying before they talk. And then, you know, and sometimes you find that people come out with things that are absolute genius that you hadn't thought about yourself. So, for all of those reasons, inclusion is so important, and diversity. So I really champion that. And I love to see it happen in the workplace. I love to see it when people come out with surprises. And I also think that by better Better ways to embrace inclusion means that people are more willing to talk about themselves. And, you know, I can give you a really nice example of this, I think, where I worked previously. I worked with a young lady who had bipolar. And there were days when it was very difficult for her and very challenging. And she may have experienced, you know, emotion or frustration. And she never really talked much about that side of herself, which is totally her right. But actually, when she did say something, people around her just went, okay, no, you know, and it was like, it's not an issue. It's not a problem. I had a conversation with her. I wasn't her direct manager, but I had a conversation with her. And she said, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, it's just one of those days. And I said, so you don't need to apologize. You don't need to apologize for being you. It's okay. And she actually got quite emotional. She said, nobody said that to me before. And, you know, her superpower is that she's really smart at what she does. She's very, very good at what she does for a living. And, you know, as part of learning and development, she helped create such engaging content for people because she's very, very clever at creating animations and graphics and things that just pop out on a screen that people wouldn't expect and just really engage people. And she never really accepted the compliments very well or realized how good she was at it. But people like her, and there are so many people like her who are generally quite quiet and modest, but actually need to be championed sometimes because they're exceptional at what they do. And that's, for me, a really great example, I think, of diversity and inclusion, is letting someone know that it, whatever you might be going through, it's okay. It's not a problem.
Yeah, I completely get what you're saying there. I mean, where are we now? We're at the beginning of 2025, tail end of January 2025, as we're recording this. You look at what's going on in the media, the world. If you've just got to spend an hour on LinkedIn, there's a whole load of pushback against EDI, D&I initiatives. It's got a bad name. You've just given some really good examples where DEI makes sense, how it helps. How has it gone wrong? You know, what should people be? Because I talk about positive people experiences. It's not about the D, the E, the I. How can I create environments where people can thrive? So how do we get back to that so we're not caught up on these acronyms and the negativity that's going around it?
I think one of the ways is about understanding, because I think that organizations know that diversity, equity and inclusion is something they need to be aware of. And there'll be plenty of people who will dive into that and really delve into what it means. But whether enough people do, I'm not sure. So I think there's a danger that people may want to create a little bit of a tick box exercise around it to be so that they can be seen or can report that they promote it and they recruit with that in mind. But I think a better understanding of it means it becomes more natural rather than a thing people have to do. And I think when people are told you must include this in your process, in your policies, etc., most people will agree quite happily to do it, but whether they'll really understand why is the difference. So one of the things that I think would be amazing in the future is if it was part of an organization's DNA and not, and don't forget, we need to have a policy on it. We want to see more of this really natural process so that nobody has to ask the questions of an organization. Do you include people? Are you inclusive? And how are you inclusive? What does that mean to you? So it's a deeper understanding, I think, that means that people will think more naturally about it. And it comes back into a space where it doesn't need to be an issue or a challenge. It's just, you know, everybody's different. I mean, the one thing I think that interests me, certainly around all of this, is that actually we are all different and have been since the dawn of time. So why is it such a problem for people to perhaps get jobs, you know, because we are all different. Some differences are maybe more obvious than others, more stand out than others, but we are all different. So why don't we just accept that and get on with life and go, yeah, everybody is different. And that's great, because what sort of world would we be in if we were all the same? So any difference is not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a little bit, you know, no, utopia.
I think that's the root of it. And sometimes we get hung up on zero-sum games or I'm getting more than you are. And people may be feeling more, you know, people who are used to privilege feeling marginalized because they're not getting the leg up that people who are marginalized get. And, you know, that's not the fundamental purpose of equity. It's about bringing people up, not pulling people down. So you're in an L&D, learning development role. As you're talking, I was thinking about, you know, things like Hertzberg's two-factor theory, where we've got the hygiene factors, our motivational factors. But in the middle of that, performance is all around the skills and having the tools in order to perform in that job, the capability, if you like. So how do you, as an L&D professional, develop processes, content, tracking, metrics, data, whatever it is, to ensure that we're being person-centric enough to develop learning and enhance skills in an inclusive way?
Yes, it's an interesting question, and it's quite a tough one, because when you're designing training content, for example, you have, as an L&D person, you've got a lot of factors to consider, actually. So you could be designing a piece of content because it's part of organizational strategy. You could be doing it because there's, you know, things going wrong in the workplace that need retraining. People need to learn about things. And you can be, to some degree, sometimes a little limited on how how wide-ranging you can be with a piece of content that you're creating. But I think what you must always do as a creator of training is put yourself in the position of the learner. So forget what you know as an L&D professional and go, right, if I'm learning this, what do I need to know? And what's the best way for me to know that? And that kind of leads you to create content that is a bit more engaging and more human-centered. And, you know, a lot of the time you can take real scenarios that people have been in. And that helps, because that then makes the training more relatable. Yeah, and there are other aspects that you can always be aware of, such as, you know, does the software that you're using to create this training, does it have accessibility standards attached to it, so that we know that, you know, for example, if somebody might be short of sight or can't hear properly, you know, will they be included in this training? But also, as I've said, I think the human side of things. So if I give you an example, so if we're creating some training on mental health and well-being, for example, what really hits home for people is when somebody is on camera and they talk about their own personal experience of something. And that can make a huge difference. So I think there's, you know, there's a variety of ways you can approach it. But I believe really that the scenario-based training and the human-centered stuff, where you've got somebody on camera who talks about it, who's an expert in it, for example, or has experienced it, that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, I resonate with that completely, because when I deliver training and develop my training materials, I'm very focused on anecdotes and stories that bring the example to life. And I've got a whole repertoire of examples that have been in the news over the last 5-10 years. And, you know, it's sometimes called newsjacking, where what you're doing is you're taking something out of the news of the moment and putting it in. Because it makes it really live, because everyone's seen it in the news, it's topical, it's going on at the moment, which means it really is relatable. Or telling the story about something that happened as if it was only yesterday and bringing it to life again. And people, I've really noticed that people really resonate with that. It also means that you're not necessarily giving an opinion on something. You're reporting a scenario and getting people to analyze that themselves and come up with their own thoughts and conclusions around it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's the power in it, is that rather than just telling people how to think, what to think, when to think it, you just empower them to explore how they feel about it. So, you know, some scenario-based or some people that we get on video, some of what they talk about can be really emotional. But I love that, because that gets into people and they go, oh, okay, I can either empathize with this or sympathize or understand better. And it allows people to then, you know, question themselves and go, well, what can I do differently then? What am I learning from this experience? What can I do differently to make it better next time? And those to me are the golden nuggets of learning, is somebody being able to understand something resonates, and then you can take that back into your job, into your daily life, into your home life even, you know, and actually do something differently. And behavioral change, there's the words. So in L&D, behavioral change. And that's what most organizations want from a learning experience, is behavioral change. So, and particularly around this subject area of diversity and inclusion, behavioral change. We want people to do something differently, but we need people to understand why they want to do it differently. You can't just tell someone, I want you to do that differently. They need to feel inside of them that they know why. And that the outcomes will be better. And that's the real sort of heart of it, I think.
Yeah. That why is so important, because if you're not careful, what happens is you tell them the why, and that doesn't land because their why is different. So you have to get people to think about what their why is. Why do I care? Why does it bother me? Why am I here? What am I doing? If you don't track their why, they'll never act, think, or feel differently as a result, will they? They won't move from A to B. They'll just stay where they were because they didn't resonate.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that, you know, people who are responsible for behavioural change in their organisations need to make sure that the training that's delivered in whatever format that might be, whether that's in a classroom, face-to-face, online, e-learning, podcast, whatever it might be, needs to resonate and it needs to land. And that's how you'll see behavioural change in organisations.
Yeah, I'm also drawn to the other L&D mantra around the Aristotle's rhetoric, ethos, logos, and pathos. We've got to tick those boxes, you know, the models of persuasion, where we're focusing on the emotional. That's also the logical and the ethical side. We've got to try and balance that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And those things are all very valid and are all part of what organizations have to go through, particularly where there is legislation that governs, you know, in the Equality Act, you have protected characteristics. So as soon as any form of compliance or legality comes into it, it kind of gives it a different spin for organizations sometimes, I think, because they go, right, okay, I need to be really careful. I need to make sure there's a policy. Yes, you do. And I need to make sure that there's learning. Yes, you do. But that's where it goes back to what I think we've just said about what type of learning. You know, what are you going to do here? Are you going to tick a box? Or are you going to change behaviours?
Yeah, but that's part of the problem sometimes, is there's no why associated with the policy. The policy is almost like a statement of fact, the Equality Act statement of fact, employment law statement of fact. Yes, some people get the why, but a lot of people go, oh, policy, processes, procedures, yawn, boring. Yeah, what's in it for me? Indeed. What do I care? And when you have to bring in the pathos, the emotional connection, or beat them with a stick around the business case, the logical.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I can give you another example of, I used to create economic crime training, and that's all regulation, legislation, and everybody knows about things, for example, like anti-money laundering. But what I wanted to do when I created training around that topic, albeit that it was purely for compliance reasons, I wanted to draw the learner in to say, to not approach it as, oh, I've been told by my organization I've got to do this. Every 12 months, we tick a box and we're done. I wanted to bring some emotion and human behavior into the topic of anti-money laundering. So I opened the course with a narrative that says money laundering is not about money. It's actually about people, victims of crime. And that could be people who've been trafficked, been abused, vulnerable people that have been taken advantage of, and people who have been defrauded of money. And this could be any one of us. And I really wanted that message to be really strong, because I wanted the learner to go, okay, maybe I hadn't thought about it like that. So when you tell the learner that in their job within, you know, if they're working in a bank, for example, and they're front line, so they're facing customers, when you tell them that actually that person standing in front of you could be a victim of crime, they could be being forced into doing something, and that can happen to absolutely anybody, then you get a different response from people. People go, oh, okay, now I'm getting it. Now I'm understanding actually why this is so important. And I got a bit of feedback from a learner, and what they wrote on the feedback was, now I understand my role in this. And for me, that was a win. That was a total win, because that's, as an L&D professional, that's what you want. You want people to go, oh, okay, I get it, and see it differently because the behavior changes. And for me, that was a great day, because that's what you're aiming for.
I always get a huge amount of satisfaction from the end of session wrap up, you know, the feedback session, the what have I learned? What am I going to do now? You know, going around the room and saying, what's the one thing you're going to take away from today? And you hear all the things that you've been thinking they were going to resonate with, that they're all picking them out. Brilliant. I've done my job, because you're actually repeating back to me what I thought was the key elements of this. And you've got it. And also you're hearing it, that social proof, because you hear it from your colleagues as well. So it stops being me telling you, you know, telling each other, and becomes more real then, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It almost gives gravitas or kudos to what you've just done. Because for so much of what you do in learning and development, sometimes it can be that, okay, this is a course I've got to put together and I've got to roll it out and get it done. And sometimes, that is the case. And it might be that actually you are rolling out a piece of learning and development that is going across an entire organization, which could be a huge organization. It could be 5,000 people who are all getting the same message at the same time on a particular subject area. But it should never stop you from just trying to bring in that human center every time, because that is the way to get people to shift their mindset. So that is my approach. And I wouldn't call it a mantra, because it's too wordy for a mantra, but it is my approach. It's about drawing people in. Because as a person who takes a lot of time and effort to create training, you just do want to want people to give you feedback, and you do want to know that what you're doing is making a difference.
Yeah. So I suppose in my early days of delivering training, you don't realize, or you're just maybe not focusing on it, because I've now come to realize that the danger is when people get up off their chairs and they leave the room, half of what you've given them, it gets left on the desk. They don't take it with them. Or, you know, worst if the phone rings, they kind of rush for a train. By the time they've done the next thing, the previous 4 hours have almost vanished from their thought process. So it's really trying to create stuff that really does stick, isn't it? That's where the little anecdotes and the stories, they may not remember the detail, but they'll remember that story for days, weeks, hopefully years afterwards.
Yeah, because they remember how they felt. And that's the key word. How did they feel? Yeah, if something makes you feel something, as you say, you won't necessarily remember all the details, but you'll remember that feeling. And that's great.
Yeah, I also get a lot of satisfaction by, if I can train an entire cohort of, you know, all of the senior leadership team, all of the SLT, whatever it may be, then even if it's not in the same session, you've then given them shared language, shared stories, and they can then repeat stuff without having to explain stuff to each other. They can just say, remember the story.
Yeah,
remember that. And suddenly the whole culture of the organization is embedded with these fables, if you like, or these sagas that they've learned together. And it becomes a new shared language they can use. And I think that's really powerful as well, because it embeds into the culture. And that's where the real change happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that what's so important about training at a senior leadership level is that the filtering down. And I don't know that a lot of that happens all of the time, because there is a challenge that I see a lot, particularly when you apply for jobs. You see a lot of recruitment mentioning learning culture. So you might come in as an L&D manager and they will say, well, we want you to help embed a learning culture. And there is only so much that an L&D manager can do with that. And it's not all the L&D's responsibility. It absolutely, you must promote it. But actually, if you've got senior leaders who've done some really great training and enjoyed it, they should be telling people, they should be letting people know in whichever way they communicate with their organization, but they should be talking about it, because that will make a huge difference.
Learning has to be fun, doesn't it? I mean, if it's not, you know, it's like whenever anyone says to me, I haven't got time for that, or we're too busy, what you mean is what you consider the thing you're too busy for, you don't prioritize, or it's not fun, or you're not enjoyable, because you've always got time to have fun or chill out or do something you want to do. So it's about priorities at that point. So how do we make learning fun and a priority, in which case you'll do it?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, doing things together as a team or competing on something even, you know, some people really enjoy competition and they want to, you know, do better than the next person sitting next to them. But in the spirit of banter and team relationships, and I think sometimes senior management really enjoy that, actually. They like a bit of that, you know, it reminds them that they're really good at something and that they're, you know, how important that is to them. But yeah, making learning fun is always important where it's appropriate to do so. And I think that when you can get people together in a room and give them a challenge, a problem to solve together, so that you as a facilitator, you lead the session, but you let them do the work, do it all and discover it and lead it and enjoy it and come to their own conclusions. Those are really great sessions as well, because they're lively and everybody is different in that group and they will each have something to offer. Some people might be really good at strategy and might think of a really cool way to do something. Other people might be really good at communication and driving a team forward. So all those great things, if you can get people in a room to problem solve, that's always a really cool way to get people into things and energize them, because people don't have a lot of time to learn. And when you want people to make time to learn, you've got to give them an incentive, really. You've got to give them some sessions that they go, God, I really enjoyed that, actually. It was worth the 1 hour I took out of my day. You know, and a lot of employees want to know how organizations will develop them. It's a question that employees ask, how are you going to develop my career? And then you might find that those people come in and go, well, I haven't got time for my training. I know I've got to do a bit of training, but I haven't got time this week. I'll put it off till next week, or I'll do it the week after that. And it's kind of, there's a two-way street here. You know, lots of organizations will provide you with the learning. You've got to put the time in, and you can do, but you've got to be attracted to it as well. You've got to want to.
You mentioned the buzz phrase, psychological safety, in your show notes. I think you mentioned it in your intro. One of the core tenets of psychological safety is learner safety, isn't it? And the fundamental principle of that is being able to make mistakes in a safe environment. So that's often scared to get it wrong, because we're going to be vilified, berated, humiliated, laughed at, whatever it may be. It's so important for organizations to create sandboxes where people can play, isn't it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I've been there. You know, before I was in learning and development, I was working in an operational team in a bank. And, you know, and I made a mistake that actually cost the bank a little bit of money, but nothing huge. But, and I was terrified. But my manager was just so brilliant. And he said to me, look, we all make mistakes. Make sure you learn from it. Don't let it happen again. But it's okay. It's okay that you made a mistake. And I felt comfortable to tell him, because I actually knew I'd made the mistake. And when I realized it, I was like, oh, I have to go and tell him. And he was brilliant. And he just, you know, he said what he needed to say. But I felt psychologically safe to go and tell him. And that the sign of good management. But everybody should feel safe to be able to say when they're worried about something, when things are going wrong. And, you know, I've personally had the challenge of being in an environment where I didn't feel I could say what was happening. And, you know, it caused me some issues. It was a difficult experience to go through, but it does happen to people. But it is so important that organizations realize that the promotion of psychological safety is paramount, because if your staff can't talk to their managers or can't talk to someone in an organization about what might be happening, then you potentially could lose really good people, because they're fearful of what the outcome might be, or they might have a perception of how they might be thought of or perceived. So it's psychological safety is for some teams I've worked in, it's quite natural, actually. It's, you know, everybody respects everybody else and everybody can speak when they need to and say if they're not happy about something or say if they need something to be different. And this includes things like setting boundaries, which I think is a really difficult thing to do, actually. Sometimes it can be really challenging to be at work and set boundaries of, you know, how people might talk to you about certain things, you know, what one person finds really funny and banter, somebody else may not. And trying to show people how you want them to work with you without, you know, coming across as like, oh, okay, well, that could be awkward, that could be difficult. A really good example I read recently on LinkedIn, I think it was, a lady wrote an article, and she just essentially joined a new organization, quite a senior level. And she said, right, I don't answer emails after 6 o'clock at night, and you won't get an email from me after 6 o'clock at night. I don't work weekends, and you will not hear from me at weekends. And if you try to contact me on a weekend, I won't contact you back. Actually, what she was doing is setting boundaries so that she has a good work-life balance and doesn't have to worry about, oh God, what happens if I miss that email or if I don't take that phone call. And feeling psychologically safe to be able to speak like that and be so upfront about your boundaries, I found it a real breath of fresh air, actually, and I admire it greatly. And I think certainly in my next role, that's what I will do. I will set boundaries, because a lot of us don't do it when we should do, and we need to, because otherwise people don't know what we will deal with, what we won't deal with. And it's fair to set your own boundaries. It just makes life easier for you, easier for other people. But it can be quite scary. People can be quite afraid of it. And this is something that I find really interesting. And the more I analyze it and talk to my friends about it, the more I realize is that in actually lots of aspects of life, we don't set the boundaries that we should, because we're afraid of conflict or things like that. So we just don't do it. But you pay the price if you don't set boundaries. Actually, you are perfectly entitled to say what works for you and what doesn't work for you.
Yeah, and when I'm leading teams, and I adopt this almost like creating an about me page on your website, about me, and I encourage team members, maybe we're starting a new project, we've got new people around the table, to do a quick round the table about me. What makes me happy? What makes me sad? What makes me effective? What makes me less effective? And I often describe it as, you know, you go into the kitchen in the office above the, and you've got on the back of the cupboard door a little sheet, how I like my tea and coffee, milk, two sugars, whatever it is. If it's coffee, I want it this, I want decaf. So we're all happy to declare how we take our tea and coffee, but we're less willing to declare how we like to be communicated with at the times of day. If you see me looking down, give me space to come round before I look up. Don't pounce on me if you're going to send me an email. I'm a literal person. I'll take whatever you write without emotion. So if you mean it to be funny, you need to say, I'm trying to be funny. Here's what I'm saying. So
yeah,
if we all have the opportunity to declare our about me, then we can all start to interact. And once you've said it out loud and someone says, oh, I forgot, you go, yeah, you did say that, didn't you? So, oops, my bad. So, and again, if the leader or the person in charge around the table invites people to share the about me, starting with themselves, this is how I work, and then that sets the tone where everybody feels that they can be themselves and set their own boundaries. I think what you're saying there is really, really important.
Yeah, it's very effective. I've worked in a team where that happens, actually, exactly that situation where the manager said, right, we're going to do an about me and we're each going to write down how we'd like to work with each other, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And it was interesting. And we learned things about each other that we didn't know before either. And it's a worthwhile thing to do. And it's an important thing to do, to set boundaries.
Yeah, also some of that is around the core tenets of emotional intelligence is around being self-aware. Actually, if someone says to you, tell me about your communication style, tell me about this, tell me about it, most people go, I never really thought about it, but now you've asked, And then suddenly you start to understand more about who you are and what makes you happy, what makes you sad, what makes you tick, that you may not have even considered without being challenged or asked to describe it.
Yeah. And you mentioned emotional intelligence, which I think is another really key aspect of organizations and, learning and development. I talk about it and write about it and do courses on it. And it's massively important. And I think that subject on its own has grown legs. So a lot more people are aware of emotional intelligence and what it means and how to use it. And again, it just creates a more inclusive environment if particularly management are emotionally intelligent and empathetic and can appreciate listening to other people rather than making assumptions about things and using emotional intelligence to ensure that they treat everybody as individuals and not just a blanket view of how to manage people, for example. And that, managers come under a lot of stress, I think, and a lot of responsibility around trying to be all things to all people and try to be different. Everybody expects their manager to understand them and treat them as an individual. And if you've got, a lot of people to manage, that could be quite a hard thing to do. But emotional intelligence is an interesting topic area because it's important, but not everybody has it. So what do you do with people who perhaps don't have a well-developed emotional intelligence, but are actually in a role where they need to be more inclined in that way? It can be quite a difficult thing to overcome.
We called this episode From Burnout to Brilliance, and you have your own burnout journey. Do you want to just, if you don't mind sharing it, tell us that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I discovered that I was going through burnout in October of last year. And what kind of led me to that point was that I had started a really, really great job. I was so excited for it. But there'd been some events leading up prior to that I hadn't really dealt with. And I hadn't been looking after myself very well. So when I went into this new job, I actually found myself almost paralyzed, almost incapable of doing it. And I was really stressed out and really unhappy, very emotional, cried a lot, don't mind admitting. There was a lot of tears and stress. And I just felt incapable of doing the job I'd been hired for. And I didn't know why. So it was a little bit like an out-of-body experience in the sense that I could almost see myself looking down on me at my desk, thinking, why aren't you doing the things you need to do? What's stopping you? What is going on? And in the end, I resigned from that role because I just didn't know what on earth was going on. And shortly after resigning, I did some reading around how I was feeling, and it became very obvious, certainly to me, then that burnout is what I was experiencing. And I'm still recovering from that now. And it forced me to examine my working life, I think, my whole working life, certainly the last 20 years of my life, how had it come to this? How had this happened? Because I'm an L&D professional and I know about burnout. I've written courses on burnout. I've even done a podcast on it with a psychologist. So how is this? How have I let this happen? And it took a lot of searching through how I live my life to figure out that I had caused burnout. Because initially I was like, it was, you know, various other things that had happened and they were certainly contributing factors. But actually I had caused burnout. And that was a really big realization for me. And it forced me to rethink everything from, you know, nutrition, exercise, boundaries, all sorts of things just kind of came to the surface. And I had to address each one of them in turn and figure out how I was going to do things differently so that I didn't end up burnt out again. And self-care was the biggest problem, really. And I thought self-care was a selfish thing. So I always put me to the back of the queue. And then I discovered actually that self-care is not selfish at all. In fact, it's massively important.
Did you find yourself just grabbing more and more things and piling responsibilities and stuff on top of yourself with this feeling that if I don't do it, nobody will? I've got to be seen as competent. I've got to be seen as capable of all these things. And if I don't do everything, I feel kind of incapable myself. You know, it's the imposter syndrome, the covering up. And those, is that what becomes sort of like this?
All of those things. Absolutely. Yeah. All of those things and more. And that's been a real voyage of discovery for me, actually, because I had to figure out why I believed that I had to be brilliant at everything, perfect at everything, or else I was going to be letting people down or I would be seen as a failure. And what I discovered is that I had set those perceptions. I believed that's what people thought of me when in actual fact, they had never said that to me. Nobody's ever sat me down and said, well, you better be perfect or else. But you impose those things on yourself. And that's why burnout is self-inflicted in my case. I don't know if in everybody's case, but in my case it was, because I had not set boundaries and had this perception that I had to be perfect at everything, or somebody was going to find me out and think I was a fraud, or which is ridiculous because I was none of those things. But I worried about that and worried about it too much, and believed that other people needed me to be a certain way or be a certain thing when they'd never said that to me. It was just me that was doing that.
Yeah, I had an example recently where I was leading a team and I was a bit concerned that one of the team members was becoming very agitated, very kind of angsty and sort of sparky, and it was difficult to get hold of them. And then when you're talking to them, oh, I haven't got time for that. I can't do this. And you criticize the wrong word, give feedback or offer a different way of perspective. That I haven't got time to do this. I haven't got time. They said, well, hang on a minute. What are you doing then? And they started talking about what they were doing. I said, okay, everything you're doing is absolutely fantastic and really, really wonderful, but not that important on the scale of things. Really, you should be doing a bit more A, B, and C, not D, E, and F, and they're putting all their energy into D, E, and F, and A, B, and C, which is the core metrics of what they're being evaluated on, is what's failing. And it's really hard to navigate that conversation, because what you don't want to do is demotivate somebody from this high pedestal of, I'm covering everybody here. If it wasn't for me, we'd all fall apart. I've got everything here. And there's this other lady I was mentoring, and she had this a similar role where she felt like the business don't see me. They're not valuing my position. If I'm not here, well, who's going to do that? And then they were made redundant. And they said, how can they possibly? They just don't understand what I do. And without saying so, I thought, well, actually, you don't understand what they want you to do. And maybe that's why you've been made redundant, because you're not actually delivering on what matters to the business. Regardless of whether you think it's right or not, the business doesn't value you because you're not delivering what they need. And that's what happens in burnout. You get so transfixed on your belief of good and not everybody else's.
Absolutely right. That's scarily correct. And it's, you just you lose yourself when you go through burnout. You completely lose yourself and you don't recognize your behaviors. And it's really scary, actually, burnout, because you become really different to the person you're used to being and the capable person you're used to being and the problem solver that you're used to being and all of those things that people see you being. I almost said expect you to be, but again, they don't expect you to be that. You've set that expectation, not them. But, you know, I was a carer for a wonderful friend of mine for 7 years, and she passed away shortly before I started this new job. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have more time on my hands to do this job, because it was a big role that I'd taken on. But actually, I hadn't even thought about grieving or how to deal with that. I organized a funeral, you know, looked after her estate and, you know, paid bills and contacted people and done all those things that people have to do. But I was just drowning in it. And I wasn't prepared to accept initially what was going on until I had to resign. And then I had no choice but to accept and dive into it and go, right, how has this happened? How do I make sure it doesn't happen to me again? And, you know, I went to my GP because it's important to get help when you're going through this. And it turns out that I'm severely anemic, which had probably caused 3/4 of what was actually going on. Because, you know, I wasn't well, essentially. You know, my body wasn't fit enough. My mind wasn't fit enough to be able to function anymore. And it just forces you to reevaluate and reset. But for me, you know, maybe it's a bit of a gift, actually, when that happens. Because it is your body's way of forcing you to stop. Because there are other ways your body could force you to stop. And you don't want those things to happen. So listen to your body and listen before burnout gets to you. You know, if something's different about you, you're feeling different, just explore that, because yeah, you don't want that road.
And without sounding morbid or disrespectful, if you drop down dead or you throw your toys at the pram and walk off and not come back, we carry on without you. We figure it out.
Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah, the fact that you may believe you're the essential cog in the entire machine holding the weight of the world up. Right. Actually, people don't perceive you in that way, they'll just adapt around you when you're not there.
Yeah, it's very true. And at the end of the day, you owe it to yourself to care for yourself. And that's where my recovery started, is caring for myself and reminding myself that it's not selfish, it's essential. And so I live differently now. You know, I practice gratitude and just spend a little bit of time every day going, you know, thanks for today. And it might not have been the best day of the week, but still breathing and, you know, still got people around me who love me and care for me. So, you know, there's always a little something somewhere to be grateful for. So I spend a bit of time doing things like that and just, you know, reminding myself that, you know, work is not the be all and end all.
Yeah, but it's so easy to forget, isn't it? It's so easy to forget. And also the other side of that is it's being a partner, wife, mother, father, whatever your home role is. You can also take on the weight of the world in your social situations. You're in a club, you're in society, you're in a friends group. You're the one that always organizes it. You're the one that books the table. You're the one that sorts out the taxis. And suddenly, you're the one that's not actually enjoying everything. You're just becoming the mother hen, clucking and making sure everyone else is okay.
Yeah.
So we've got to be careful. We're not swapping work burnout, social burnout, and family burnout. They all mass together, don't they?
Yeah. And this for me, I think, comes back to setting boundaries. You know, it's great to support people and be the mother hen sometimes, but you don't have to be it all the time. And if you don't want to be it, then tell people, tell your friends, actually, do you know what? Can you organize the taxi this time? You know, just set boundaries and just tell people how you feel. Because once people realize, most people, kind people, are going to go, oh God, okay, sorry about that. Yeah, that's, you know, that's fine. No problem, of course.
Yeah.
You know, but you don't. A lot of the time you just keep it in. And that's, you know, that's where it can go a little bit wrong, I think. Did for me.
Yeah, certain person. I mean, it sounds like you've got a similar personality to the one I'm thinking about here. You feel like you've got this weight of expectation. People put you in a box. This is how I have to behave. I have to be here, there. And sometimes I realize when I got into those sort of modes where you end up doing everything, you can actually walk away very slowly, just step back occasionally, not step forward first, lean away and see who else would pick it up. And then actually you can sort of sometimes say to yourself, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. Honestly, I could say no. Wow. I said no and it didn't matter.
It's liberating when you do.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, I think absolutely.
Maybe some of that comes with age. You know, I've just turned 60. I keep saying I don't know how that happened. You know, I was 20, 21 a minute and then suddenly I'm 60. I think maybe maturity and age, you start to realize that there are different things that are important in life. And I've moved from an environment where I was always thinking about gluttony, wanting more, bigger, faster, stronger, the best, this, that, the other. Not to becoming lazy, but focusing on sufficiency. What do I need to survive? What's my contribution to keep this alive, to keep this moving? And not worrying about burning the midnight or candle at both ends, all those metaphors and analogies. And actually thinking, what makes me happy here? And yeah, it's liberating, I think.
Yeah, you're very right. And that's why I say burnout for me has actually been a gift, a weird gift, but a gift nonetheless. And it has made me rethink all of those things, all of the priorities. And I'm doing really well now. And I'm excited, you know, for my next venture. I think one thing I can take, or several things I can take back to a learning and development role as well, is that I can share my experience now. So I can deliver training about how to avoid burnout or how to get through it and recover from it, because I've lived it and I'm living it. And that's, you know, there's a silver lining, right? So, you know, if I can teach or help one other person understand how to avoid burnout or how to get through it, then that for me is great.
And isn't that a great mantra to change the life or influence the life of one other person? And again, this burnout challenge is you want to change the world. You want to fix everything. But actually, if I can fix me, if I can make me a better person and help influence other people around me to be better people, that's my mission, really. Can't change everybody, but I can change me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so important. So we were talking earlier about victims of crime and how people who are sometimes coerced into committing crimes, and it may not be, there's more than one dynamic going on there, not just the criminal intent, but also the victim intent as well. Well, I do a lot of work with a recruitment firm who focus on getting people who they would call radicals back into the workplace, because there's still a lot of stigma around people who are previously incarcerated, previously committed crimes in the employment process. And people are risk averse about, if I take on you, maybe you'll embezzle me, defraud me, or whatever, or violence, whatever it may be. How can we help people who have been through that process of the criminal justice system, if you like, find better chances of employment?
I've never really thought about it like that before, but I think that one of the things that's important is that even people who've been incarcerated can have and do have skills. And if somebody is remorseful, then the justice system know that and will allow them to leave prison. And therefore, as a society, however hard this might be, we have to accept that they have served their time and that we want to focus on what they've got to offer, and understand that people want to move forward and they need to be given the chance to do so.
Yeah, I would reflect on the fact that most people make a left turn instead of a right turn. There's a pivotal moment in their life, and that is often, as you said earlier, bound being coerced, being in a toxic environment, being just with the wrong people, and it just you have a personality type that says yes instead of no. You turn left and turn right, and a lot of people end up in this pivotal situation where if you wind the clock right back, and they had to make that decision again, they wouldn't make that same decision. So it's recognizing how we can almost regress people back to that point where they hadn't committed the crime, and then saying, okay, how can we help you at that point there, isn't it?
Yeah. What would you have done differently if you go back now? What would you do differently? Yeah. And I think that if people can articulate that and understand their actions and the consequences of their actions, then that's rehabilitation, right? That's getting people back into a state of mind where they're able to not commit crime and to make better decisions.
We're all one bad decision away from being destitute and homeless and relationshipless, having a drink in a pub and getting in your car. One bad decision. It's not even premeditated, and your life changes. You know, we see teenagers on the news who crash their cars with their friends in the back, and everybody's life changes.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people are affected.
In a split second. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not, I think when we're working with organizations, we go back to the inclusion and the thinking about it is not prejudging someone as bad. We're giving people opportunity and seeing into the heart of people and creating opportunities for them to thrive in the way they can.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody deserves a chance.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, everyone deserves. I mean, I guess there are only so many chances before you have to give different chances. Everyone needs opportunity and coaching and mentoring, shown different opportunities. Yeah. Emma, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting to you. I can't believe we've been nattering for well over an hour now, and plus a bit in the green room before it. How do people get a hold of you? I mean, tell us about, you've got a podcast, haven't you? Tell us about your podcast.
Yeah, it's called Let's Talk About Burnout. And I'm really just sharing my whole experience, how I realized it had happened to me, the things that have happened over the last 20 years that have led to that point, and episodes on recovery. So, you know, there's a lot of hope in it. There's a lot of joy in it as we go through it. But it's really important for people to take a good, long, hard look inside yourself when you go through burnout, because you need to examine yourself. So I'm just really sharing what I've done, how I've done it, in the hope that I can help people who are going through it, or help perhaps even prevent it. And it's fascinating. And if anybody wants to get in touch, then they can get hold of me. I'm on LinkedIn, and my email as well, emma.parnell1@virginmedia.com. And I'm inviting people to come and talk and share their stories too, because there's nothing better than a two-way conversation. And I'm looking forward to inviting some experts along as well to give some really great advice on recovery.
That sounds fascinating. Maybe I'll drop you a line, because I've got some burnout stories and some pivotal moments in my life that I've turned left instead of right, or right instead of left. Sometimes I've been a bad girl on a couple of occasions in my life, but you can't. I don't think you get to the age of 60 without making a few wrong turns here and there.
Indeed, and I would love for us to talk again, Joe. I think we've both got a lot to go through and discuss. I'm 53 now, so I've lived some bits and pieces as well. But it'd be lovely to talk again sometime.
Excellent. Well, I'll put all the details of the podcast and your contact on LinkedIn stuff in the show notes, which people can check out. And if you're listening, please give Emma a shout and say hi. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Joanne. It's been brilliant to talk to you today.
A pleasure.
Bye.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.